And that brings us to the end of Border Radio for today. I'm Susan Darrow, your host for this program. We're here with you Monday through Friday from 3 to 6, and I thank you so much for spending just a little bit of your afternoon and evening with me and KPFT. Tune us in tomorrow. Again, we'll be here with another edition of this program on the Mighty 90 KPFT Houston from 3 to 6 in the afternoon. Please don't go anywhere. So What's Your Story is next on KPFT.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them, right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Keene, backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, we feature guests who'll take us on magical journeys through their stories. Well, now we'll hear from Bo Bennett. Bo was born and raised in Connecticut. He's got a PhD in social psychology, and lately Bo has been writing books and screenplays, and Bo also runs a company called Archie Boy. And you can read all about what he does on his website at bobennett.com. Hey, Bo, welcome back to So What's Your Story.
Thanks for having me back. It means that I did something right the first time.
Definitely.
Yeah. Or you were desperate for guests, one or the other.
No. We're going over some of our old tapes, and we went over that one from that show. Hey, we got to get this guy back on again.
Sounds good to me. I like that option better.
So now the last time you were on our show, you shared some stories from your book. It's called A Mostly Magnificent Memoir. And now I know this book is fictionalized to a certain extent, but are those stories based on true stories?
Yes. And I would argue that anybody who claims to write a 100% true autobiography, they're lying. Or maybe they don't know they're lying, but I will guarantee it's not 100% true, because, you know, being having a PhD in psychology, I could tell you that the mind, the human mind and the memory does not work that way.
Right.
The memory is not like a tape recorder where we watch something and then we could kind of play it back. In a sense, it's more of like it's a creative process where we could have a memory, but the more we recall that memory and tell it, and then we save it into memory again with a little change, maybe a little elaboration, and that process continues over and over, the final story could be vastly different from what actually happened. Now, there's third parties who could actually corroborate what happened. And my story is it involves like friends and family and parents and stuff. So I do have some cooperation. But yes, the stories are all true, like all the major details and the major turning points, they're all true. But yes, I definitely did fictionalize some, not just by accident, but also on purpose, to make the story more compelling and entertaining and humorous, because I really wanted to write like a comedy, and a
Sure.
comedy with some drama. Maybe it's like a dark comedy, but that's what it is.
So you took some liberties, but we can basically assume that you went through some of this stuff.
Yes, yeah, more than that. I mean, it's true, it happened. And the details that don't matter, the ones that sound kind of funny and outrageous, were
Right.
probably made up. But that's not the important point. So I think to make people laugh, to make people smile, I think they'll be okay with that.
I'm with you on that. Well,
Sure.
let's hear some from that book.
Sure. Yeah. I think last time I told you about like my parents and my upbringing. Maybe let me start with a good overview of my life. Like, why would anybody want to read a story about Bo Bennett? You know, they probably have no idea who I am. I'm maybe famous in a very, very tiny circle of people who I know and maybe who I work with and so forth. But for the most part, it's an ordinary life, but it's in a completely interesting, entertaining, and amazing in another sense.
Oh, yeah.
To give you a to give you a like just a brief overview of some a synopsis of my life in general so far, at least what the stories contain. I was born back in 1972 in a small town east in Connecticut, and my parents were not really the traditional kind of parents that you would see on the Brady Bunch or in on the sitcoms of the time.
Right.
And in fact, my parents were very different than my friends' parents, and I always knew that. It wasn't a funny story, but it could be made funny. I mean, they were both serious alcoholics,
Oh boy.
and they fought all the time. I mean, it was mostly verbal, but there were definitely some spouts of physical fighting in there as well. And this is just something that we grew up with, like every day, myself, my brother, and my sister. Just constant fighting and screaming, and geez, the mouth my mom had on her. I mean,
Oh boy.
you can't really watch cable TV and compare my mom against anybody. I mean, she was that bad, the things that she would say. And don't get me wrong, I loved my parents to death, and
Sure.
I think that they were great parents. They did a great job. They did what they had to do, but and their problems weren't with us, like with their kids. My parents absolutely loved their kids, and there was no question about that. And they treated us extremely well, but they had their own personal demons that they were always fighting, you
Right.
know. And they definitely had problems with each other. They were from a different age, and they were both raised Catholic. And it was the kind of thing where you don't get a divorce, you know. That's not even
Right.
considered. It's just you're married and that's the end of it. So that's kind of the mindset they had. They were stuck with each other, in other words. And they were both, from a psychological perspective, I could say that they were both codependent. They really did need each other in an unhealthy way. So that's kind of what we grew up with. And if it really weren't for the support of my sister there for me, I don't think I would have turned out as well as I did. Because she was kind of like my second mother, my mother there to comfort me when my first mother was maybe under the influence, let's say, and on one of her binges or rants.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I grew up with. But despite all that, it was a very enjoyable and fun ride. And I like to kind of equate my story in my book to Forrest Gump. You know, I like that. It's kind of like a Forrest Gump meets a Christmas Story. And if you're familiar with a Christmas Story, that's the one with Ralphie, like from the movie from the 80s, when he has that first person narrative. And it's just like really funny stuff because a lot of funny things happen. So that's kind of like I like to kind of put those two together and say, yeah, it's kind of a mix of that. And if you're familiar with Forrest Gump or your listeners are, it's a really like endearing story that's funny, extremely funny, but it's also extremely touching in many times because life is like that. It's serious at times and it's hilarious at times. So in my writing, I just really like to point out those hilarious times, but I also don't shy away from the serious.
Sure. So in these stories, I've read a few of them and very entertaining stuff, by the way. But yeah, you don't always paint your parents in a very flattering light. Do you ever get any negative feedback from anyone in your family about this?
Not really, because most of, well, my parents have passed away probably, oh, geez, I think it's been like 15 years for my father, maybe like 30 for my mom. So it's been a while.
Right.
And most like my grandparents are all gone and uncles and aunts. We had a lot of smoking and drinking in our family. So unfortunately, at least we could call it ancestors, maybe they don't have a very long lifespan. And, I changed my life to change that. I never drank, never smoked, or drugs or anything like that. And really focus on health and fitness and eating right. Because if there are some bad genes in our family, I want to make sure that, I do everything I can to compensate for that and not suffer the same fate as my parents and their brothers and sisters. But to answer your question, not really. I wrote about my brother and sister as well, but they were both great and they are great. They're still around and I pretty much painted them in a flattering light. So they're okay with that. And they know my parents. I mean,
Sure.
there's no hiding it. Everybody knew it. So it's not like I'm divulging some family secrets that were meant to be kept away. Anybody who's ever come to our house would see my parents the way that they act and they know.
Got it.
So there's no, yeah, nobody's mad at me. At least I don't think so.
Great. Well, do you have any stories come to mind from the book?
Yeah, there's just glancing through the table of contents here, there's I'll tell you a funny story from my the early days when I was probably like six years old. I think I was in second grade at the time. However old you are in second grade, I forgot about that. But six or seven. Anyways, my we lived again in a town called Easton, Connecticut, and it was kind of like backwoodsy. So we had a nice big, maybe like 3 acre lot, wooded lot. And one of the things that I would like to do very often as a bored second grader in Easton, Connecticut, would be just to kind of hang out in the backyard and kind of play around there. Now, one quality that is kind of famous in the Bennett family is making up stories. Not, I think that's a nice way to put it, not telling the truth all the time. And let's face it, sometime we were just kind of like bold-faced liars. So when somebody said something in our family that was kind of unbelievable, it tended to be unbelieved. So I was outside playing one day, and then I came running in the house like in like kind of an excited panic. And my parents were both there, and my sister and brother were there. They're like, "What's going on?" I'm like, "There's a monkey in the tree. There's a monkey. I see a monkey." And they're like, "Oh, okay, Bowie." My mom would kind of play with me and say, "So how big was it? And was it wearing a hat?" And I automatically knew, even that age, I'm like, "Yeah, okay, she's obviously thinks I'm crazy here." So I'm like, "No, come outside." So they came outside and there's no monkey. They didn't see any monkey. So I would go on for like the next several days telling them, "I swear I saw a monkey and it was big and it was brown." And I would describe it and it was in the tree. And they're like, "Could it have been a squirrel?" I'm like, "No, it was a monkey. It wasn't a squirrel. Could it have been a dog? What's a dog doing in a tree?" So I would keep on like telling them, like, "Trust me, this was a monkey. It was in the tree." And then they were finally getting annoyed with me. And I remember my mom just like swearing, going crazy, like, "You just shut up here. You're driving us all nuts. You didn't see a monkey in the tree." And I would be crying, like, "I saw the monkey." Anyway, it wasn't until probably the next day when The news was on, Channel 5 News. And then the newscaster came on and made an announcement. He said, the monkey that escaped from Beardsley Park Zoo in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is the town right next to us, has been found. And they said the monkey was safely retrieved and no harm was done. And it was found like in the suburb of like Bridgeport on the line or something. So my parents looked at me, my brother and sister looked at me, and the truth finally came out. And like my mom gave me a hug and she's like, I'm so sorry. I'll never doubt you again. And that was like the first time I felt vindication, and it felt really good.
So there was a monkey.
There was a monkey in the tree, and yeah, you could even, I'm sure you could even Google it and search the archives somewhere around like 1978 or something, Beardsley Park Zoo, which is the zoo in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where the monkey actually escaped from.
So there's even documentation of it.
Yes. And that's, and again, that was one of the stories where like, I just never forgot it because it was such a powerful story and I remember seeing it, but you know, with false memories, could I kind of made that up? Like seeing the monkey, it's possible, but I have cooperation from my sister and brother. Like, yeah, it definitely happened.
Yeah. So, well, that one had a good ending.
It did have a good ending. Yeah. Vindication is always a good ending. So as I got older, there was another funny incident that I wrote about in the book. This was, I went to high school back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Now, if your listeners are familiar with high school in the 80s, or they're not familiar, just watch any 80s movie with high school. And high school was very different. It was funny. It like bullying wasn't a like something that where people did it, they were like, oh my goodness, he's bullying. Oh, yeah. You can't do that. No, not like today. I mean, everybody was bullying. If you were a freshman, you were bullied. That's just the way it was. Teachers didn't care, the principals didn't care. I mean, that's it. Everybody was bullying everybody. It was just the nature of high school in the 80s. And again, if you watch 80s movies, you could see how inappropriate it is. And it's just how common it is. And it's not really an exaggeration. I mean, that's kind of the way it was in our high school. And it was no different. But I was, you know, like the average size kid. There was nothing special about me going into freshman year. But one thing I know is that, you know, I didn't want to be bullied. So I think that this actually happened in my sophomore year, after a year of being bullied. You know, I was just sick of it. This is enough. So it was kind of like a fortunate incident in a way, what happened. I went to an arcade and I went alone to meet some friends who never showed up. So I played in the arcade for a while. Then I went out back to my car in the parking lot. And my car was a 1972 Chevy Nova. And I bought this in like 86 or something. So it was a real piece of crap. I paid $50 for it. I bought it from some guy in New Haven, Connecticut. When I finally got there, it's like, oh, you wanted the battery too? You didn't tell me you wanted the battery. That's an extra $100. So I paid 150 for it, 50 for the car and 100 for the battery. Drove the thing back completely unregistered, completely uninsured. Like it was, my parents were about to kill me, but it was a big piece of junk car. So when I went back to this car, the door would constantly stick. So I was going from the parking lot, trying to get into the door. And then finally I opened the door. The door whacked me in the eye and gave me a black eye. And there was like a little blood coming from it. So I was thinking, how could I use this to my advantage? So I went back to my friend's house that night. And on the way, driving to my friend's house, I'm kind of like rehearsing this whole act in my head. Like, what happened? How did I get the black eye? So then I come in my friend's house and bunch of my friends are there. They're all kind of hanging out. So I'm like, oh my goodness, guys, you wouldn't believe what happened. I was at Arnie's arcade in the parking lot. I'm going back to my car and these three guys come up behind me. They're like, hey, dude, I want your wallet. Give me your wallet. I'm like, no way. I'm not giving you my wallet. And then the guy goes to be in my pocket and get the wallet. And then I punch the one guy in the face and I do a spinning back kick. I knock the other guy off. I knee the other guy in the face. So I describe this fight scene like from a Jackie Chan movie in like perfect detail. I had every detail rehearsed, right? Because I had to make it convincing. And the way to make a story convincing is make sure you get those details, right? So I tell this whole story and then they're just like amazed. They're like, oh man, this is the best. Bo took out three guys. That's incredible. So the next day, the rumor goes around school everywhere. Like everybody in school knew what happened to me. But what I told my friends, I mean, I told them a total lie, of course. I told them that I basically beat up three guys and I was able to get away from there. But that turned into six guys when the story came around. And not only did I beat them up, but I sent them all to the hospital. Right. So I was okay with those exaggerations. You know, when people told me back the story, I didn't bother correcting them. I'm just like, yeah, I just don't want to talk about it. So anyway, that story changed everything for me. From that point on, not only did nobody ever bother me, but I had this new kind of respect from the seniors and the juniors. Like, oh, hey Bennett, how you doing? How are you today? You know, it was like I had this new status as somebody like, oh, you don't mess with the Bennett guy. Did you hear what he did? Did you hear what happened to him? So that was my story. And that's what really changed my whole high school experience from sophomore year on. And the funny thing is I maintained that story until the day I wrote my book, like, you know, a few years ago. And it was getting progressively more and more difficult because I didn't want to lie to my friends. This wasn't to impress my friends. This was to keep me from getting wedgies and get thrown in the locker. That was the point of the story. But I had to tell it to my story. I had to tell everybody, and I had to maintain this lie, which I did. And I didn't want any, because I couldn't trust any of my friends with something like this. This is something that, you know, one of them's mad at you one day, they'll tell everyone, and then everything's over. And then I'll get beat up like twice as bad. So I had to just kind of maintain this as the story. And yeah, really, I remember talking to my friends one day, like when we were in our 20s, we were hanging around and they're asking me about the story. And I'm like, yeah, I remember that. And I just didn't want to talk about it. And again, it wasn't until I wrote my book when I kind of came clean and said, yep, sorry, guys, but none of that.
By a freaking car door.
That's the truth. Well, the old 1972 Chevy Nova whacked me in the eye. That's what happened.
I'd say you made the best of that injury.
I did.
We're going to take a break from our program now for station identification and to make a few announcements. You're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM radio in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Our show is sponsored by the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild puts on various storytelling events throughout the year, including monthly story swaps, the fourth Tuesday of every month. To find out more about the Guild and maybe even join their organization, you can go to HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're at that same website, you can check out our program. Just click on the So What's Your Story tab, and you'll find archives from our show dating all the way back to the year 2008. And we're also on Facebook. Just go to So What's Your Story on Facebook and find out all the latest happenings there. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth holds monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month at the Warehouse Live Midtown on Travis Street. And now let's get back to our guest, Mr. Bo Bennett.
Now, last time you told a story about aliens, your mother's obsession, can we say, with some aliens? Any chance we could hear about that again?
It's always a funny one. Because, well, I told you a little bit about my mother already. So most of you are probably thinking like, okay, she's like this crazy alcoholic woman. Well, definitely the crazy part. But she was extremely creative. And she was the type of person who, like, her favorite newspaper was the Weekly World News. And if you don't remember that, it's kind of like the biggest fake newspaper of the time, like the aliens run the White House. And it wasn't even conspiracy theories. It doesn't even go. I mean, it's kind of like a joke. Most people see it as a joke, but every now and then they'll throw like some like real conspiracy theory in there just to kind of bring people in to believe like all of that's true. Anyways, that was what my mom believed. My mom believed in like every religion. Like, how is that possible? You know, there are so many religions that are contradictory, but she believed in like everything. She believed in ghosts. She believed in demons, you believe, like you name it, leprechauns. If there's any kind of mythical, mystical creature, she believed it.
Right.
And one of her favorite shows was the one with the guy from Star Trek, who
Oh, the In Search of or
In
something.
Search Of, yeah, right. And he would, which always I find that so ironic because he played Spock,
Yeah.
which was the embodiment of logic and reason. And here he is on the show, like talking about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and all that stuff. So my mom used to love that show. So you could imagine, like, with all of this material that she takes in, like what's going through her mind.
Sure.
So when somebody's like totally and completely immersed in that kind of world, if you see like a flashing light in the sky, it's not a flashing light. It's an alien from another planet. And not only is it an alien from another planet, but it's an alien from another planet that wants to abduct her, right?
Oh boy.
And take her away into their planet. So we were driving around in a car one night. My mom was picking us up at Lordship Roller Rink, where my sister and I were discoing it out to 80s songs. So my mom, I was 8 maybe, my sister was 14. My mom sees this light in the sky and she starts going crazy. She's like, "It's an alien. It's an alien ship." And then she turns to me and my sister and says, "Okay, Bo and Debbie, now here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go up with the aliens and they're going to take me away to their planet. And you guys don't be worried. I'm going to be perfectly fine. And Debbie, this is how you drive the car. You make sure you drive Bowie home." My sister was 14, right? So I'm like in the back crying hysterically, going crazy. My sister's yelling at my mom, saying like she's crazy. My mom's yet with her head literally sticking out the window, driving, chasing this light in the sky
Oh my.
over the hospital, going through the streets in Bridgeport, stopping and like to other people in the cars, "Do you see that light? Do you see that alien?" And then, "Yeah, I see a light in the sky." And then she would just keep on going and going and going. So it was just crazy. I mean, it was a crazy night. Eventually, the cops pull her over
Oh boy.
and give her a ticket for driving under the influence or something, even though she wasn't. They figured like she has to be being that crazy. So that was an interesting lesson learned.
Right. And did she tell the cops it was aliens?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. She and then I think that the cops eventually just figured out that yeah, this was a crazy woman and wanted to make sure that my sister and I got home safely.
Wow.
And I remember even turning to my sister and my sister saying, "No, my mom's always like this. Trust me, she's okay." Like, yeah.
Probably never a dull moment at your house.
No.
So, they say comedy is pain times distance. So I guess if it was kind of a lot of painful stuff after this many years, you can find a lot of humor in it.
Yeah, and even more so than that, my father was a extremely funny guy. And he was like always cracking jokes. He would find humor in everything. And I think that's where I get it from, whether it be some kind of genetic trait or maybe it's just a learned behavior. But I always kind of learned to look at things that happen to you, look at life the way it is, and try to make the best of it and see the humor in it. I mean, it's so funny. And I know it's not appropriate these days to laugh at a lot of things that
Right.
happen to people, but it's completely and totally appropriate to laugh at things that happen to you, no matter how bad they may be. You could do all the laughing at yourself as you want. And like I write in my book, I give people 100% permission to laugh at everything that's happened to me
Great,
because yeah,
very good.
it's I mean, it may have been painful at one point of my life, but it got me where I am today. And which is in a really good place. So I'm okay with all that.
Yeah, say you've come a long way from those days of driving
Yes.
around chasing flying saucers with your mother.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because I kind of became sort of the opposite in many ways of what my parents were like with their drinking. They were alcoholics. I never touched a drink in my life. They smoked. I never touched a cigarette in my life. My mom was like believed in everything. I believe in nothing mystical. Like I'm a scientist. So you could see like where I looked at them and said, "Okay, I don't want to be like that. I kind of went to the opposite extreme.
Oh.
But having said that, there were a lot of things that my parents did that I absolutely love, like my father and his humor. And I could look at that and say, I want to be like that. And my mom and the way that she absolutely unconditionally loved her children, that's something that I admire. And that's something that I emulate from my mom.
So, do you think maybe the dysfunctional atmosphere kind of prompted you, like, is a reaction to it to motivate you to be as successful as you are now?
I think so. It's interesting when, if you look at people in the same situation, and there's no real data on this. Like, if parents are kind of screwed up, usually the children have a stronger, a greater chance of being screwed up as well, like kind of carrying on some of those behaviors. But there are people, and many people, in fact, a decent percentage who kind of go the other way, and that was me. My brother, unfortunately, kind of got caught up in drugs and a lot of that stuff. But he's doing fantastic now.
Good.
But it took him, I mean, it really screwed up his life for quite some time. And my sister, she seemed to do just fine. So you never know. You never know what it is about, whether it's people or the circumstances. Like I said, I give a lot of credit to my sister and being there for me and
Oh, yeah.
helping me through a lot of this, which is probably one of the reasons I am here today.
Wow, that's a good tribute to her. So you talk a lot about your childhood, and it seems like your entrepreneurial spirit goes way back. I'm reading here by age 10, you let's see, started a business by creating and selling wooden key racks. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my dad was an inventor, so he worked at home. Now, although I did say my dad was an alcoholic, he was what I call a functional alcoholic. That means he never drank before 5 o'clock, like with very few exceptions, with some parties or something. But for the most part, he would not touch a sip until 5 o'clock. So he would work all throughout the day, do his job, do what needed to be done, and then he would walk upstairs from our basement, from his workshop, and start drinking until he passed out.
Oh boy.
So still not great, but he got his job done. He was functional. So in the workshop, he was an inventor. He was a brilliant guy too. He had like over hundreds of patents under his name, for all like plastics. He invented the lock on the tape measure, the lock that you actually push, you know. So I mean, that's a common. He invented the functional devices that made the wet vac work, like the shop vac
Oh
that
yeah.
allows you to vacuum up water too. So
Wow.
he's got some big things under his belt
Huh.
there. So he had this great workshop with all this woodworking machinery and lathes. So I would learn at an early age, like play around and build things, build go-karts, forts. And then I eventually built like the stupid little key rack thing. So I went and sold them to all of my neighbors. And of course, the neighbors wanted to buy them because they weren't really buying the key rack, but they were just buying my cuteness. And
Oh, yeah.
maybe they felt obligated as well because I realized two things. One, as I started leaving the neighborhood and going to people who didn't know me, they didn't really want them anymore. And two, as I got older and less cute, people really didn't want them anymore.
Well,
So selling things to neighbors became increasingly more difficult as time went on. But that was just the first thing I did. And then, like one thing after another, it was always some kind of business, some kind of get rich quick thing. You know, I wanted to be rich like ever since I could remember. My dad worked for himself, my brother did, my sister did, my mom did. Like I didn't even know that there was this thing called a job where you actually leave the house and go to a job and come back. I mean, I was just kind of born and raised in this environment of like the entrepreneurial spirit. So I did a lot of things from age 10 until age 29, when I eventually sold my first company of significant value for $20 million. So
Whoa.
it eventually worked. It just took a
Came a
lot
long
of,
way from the key holders, huh?
yeah, a lot of mistakes, a lot of key holders, a lot of stupid things that I got involved in to get to where I eventually was.
Wow. Yeah, I can see how your childhood shaped you quite a bit. Maybe if you did live in a, if you were raised in a Brady Bunch, Ozzie and Harriet, it wouldn't have been nearly as successful. Who knows?
I don't think so. I don't think so. You never know what it is exactly, like what point changes your future. But if any one thing has changed, you never know where you're going to be today.
Right, sure. So, Bo, let's hear another story from your book. I understand you got one about your college days.
Yeah, so here we are. I told you my last story when I was 16. Now we're going to fast forward until I was like 18, 19 years old. So I really never cared about going to college. As I mentioned, my dad had a workshop. I could have easily kind of took over doing what he was doing. He was doing pretty well. I enjoyed doing it, like working with plastics and working with wood. So I could have done what he did, but so I really didn't care. It wasn't until one of my friends, my best friend actually at the time, said, "Hey, Bo, you want to come up with me? I'm going up to this college in Rhode Island. I'm going to check it out." I'm like, "Sure, yeah, I'll go for the ride." Now, remember that this was my like senior year in high school, and at this time, virtually every one of my friends and everyone in class already applied to several different schools, already got into like at least one school, and here's me with no applications in, and I just didn't care. I said, if something happens, something happens. So we went to this college, Bryan College, and it was like a country club. I was walking around the campus, it was beautiful. I'm like, this is fantastic. Yeah, I'll go here. It wasn't about the education. It was about just like, this is like a country club life experience. It looks fun. Yeah, I'll do it. So I put in my application, and I got waitlisted, but I did eventually get in. So it was the only college I applied to, and I got in. So I asked my parents about this, about like paying for college, and they said, "Sure, Bo, we'll pay for you. Don't worry about it. You're the first Bennett to go to college," because my brother and sister didn't go. So they're like, "Go ahead and we'll pay for you. We'll take care of everything." I'm like, "Great." So about maybe 3 months into my freshman year, I get a call from my parents saying, "Bo, we're out of money. We can't afford to pay for your college anymore." Good luck. Essentially, that's the way the conversation went. So I was in a bind here. I'm going to this private school, and I really had like no way to pay. The last thing I wanted to do was get out a student loan and be in debt for the rest of my life. And even back in the 90s, it was still pretty high, like the cost of tuition and everything. So I devised another plan, a way to get through school without having to pay or take out student loans. Well, having to pay as much and taking out student loans, basically just a way to stay in school. The first thing I did was I became an RA, a resident assistant. So that allowed me. Oh, actually, let me back up one step. I did convince my parents to finish paying for the next semester. So they scraped up the money and they did it. They paid for my entire freshman year, which was really, really helpful. So my sophomore year, I became a resident assistant, which basically means that I could live on campus for free. I get free room and board, and I just have to kind of like monitor and do some duties and stuff. And I was perfectly okay with that. So I just had to pay for classes. So that worked pretty well. But and that kept me going for a while, but it wasn't enough. I still needed to pay for classes. So I started a business. I started an advertising specialty business, and I started my number one and my only client at the time was the school, the student activities. So I would create the pens and the keychains and the mugs and the t-shirts. I would do all that for the school, and I would get a little profit from all of that, enough to pay my way through like the classes and have some spending money. And then I thought, okay, this is great. I'm good to go. I'll just keep doing this. But at the end of my sophomore year, and remember, I went to a business school. This was Bryant College, a business school. I get called in by the dean or student, the resident director of student life, saying that it is against Bryant's policy to run a business on campus.
Ooh.
I'm like, are you kidding me? This is a business school. That's like telling the Berklee College of Music they can't sing. I mean, it's crazy. And I wasn't like having customers come in or anything. I had a computer and I had a phone and that was it. But I couldn't do it apparently. So I got kicked off campus. So my junior year, I lived off campus. I still ran the business, but it wasn't enough. So this is where it really got creative. It turns out that there was a loophole in the Bryant College classes and the admission, the way the whole thing worked. And here was the loophole. If you lived on campus, you had to be a full-time student. However, if you lived off campus, you can take three courses and be a part-time student and pay like literally one-tenth the amount per class.
Oh.
And then you could also take summer classes and you could catch up the other two that you missed, and you could still be like with your whole class. Wow. You could take the same number of classes for one-tenth the amount just by being an off-campus part-time student instead of a full-time student. So I did that, and I was able to like get the classes incredibly cheap. I ended up spending one extra summer. So I graduated with my class in 1994, where, by the way, I got to hear our commencement speaker, Bill Cosby, talk about family values.
Oh, boy. Already there. Oh, geez.
So I graduated with my class, and then I just stayed for the summer, and I finished up the last two classes. They let me graduate. You know, they do that if you're just taking a couple summer courses to fill in the credits. Mm-hmm. And I literally paid like one-tenth everybody else did. And right after I did that, my senior year, they closed that loophole.
Oh, man.
They're like, and I think they called it the Bo Bennett loophole. So that's how I got through college.
Pretty good to have a loophole named after you. Wow. Yeah, I really admire that kind of entrepreneurial. I mean, I consider myself progressive and all that stuff, but I admire guys that go out there and take the risks. And if you make a little more money doing that than other guys, I'm fine with that.
Well, it's like in that situation, the whole college thing, it's when you're put in that situation where basically you have nothing to lose. And you need to come up with a solution. I mean, it's either you do that or you're out.
Right.
So it's amazing how creative you can get right. when put in that situation.
Necessity is the mother of invention, maybe you could say.
You bet.
So what's been going on in your life since then, since the last time you were on our show about 2 years ago? Any new projects, any new books? What's new?
Yeah, well, about 2 years ago, I was in the process of writing a screenplay for a sitcom, and I actually finished that. I finished writing the first 10 episodes, and not only did I write it, but I also produced it. I got the voice actors, and I did it as an animated sitcom. I did the animation for it. Wow. So you can find that on YouTube. It's called SquatSpotFitness.com.
SquatSpotFitness. Okay.
Right. It's a sitcom that takes place at a gym, because I've been going to gym since like I was a teenager, early teenager. And I could tell you this, it's a comedic goldmine. Mm-hmm. There's so many funny things that happen at a gym. And that's why I just had like tons of notes. And I said, okay, I got to put this down. So it's a sitcom that takes place in a suburban gym. And it's you could watch it for free on YouTube at SquatSpotFitness.com. So that's one thing I did. And then I've been working with book publishing, still doing a lot of books, and heavily involved now in artificial intelligence, using AI in the book publishing business. And you can find out all about that at my business website, archieboy.com.
So what's your gut feeling on AI? Are we all doomed to be kowtowing to our computer overlords the rest of our lives?
I think we're all doomed to live a better life. That's what I think. I think
I've been hearing more about that. They're saying, hey, let's hold on. AI might be opposite of what you think it is, you know.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but for the most part, technology has always been used, well, not always, but for the most part been used to serve us. And I think that's going to continue. I think with artificial intelligence, it could free up so much of the monotony that we have to do, so much of the things that we don't want to do, but we need to do. Mm-hmm. And like I said, when you're put in the situation where you don't have to do that anymore, or maybe even you can't do it, maybe unfortunately you might have lost your job because AI takes over, you're going to be put in that situation where you have to do something different. And you're going to find that you're going to be doing something a lot more creative, a lot more personal, a lot more something that takes like the humanity in you and brings it out, whether it's a creative process or something that AI cannot do, or at least not do well, or at least not yet.
If it goes the right route, it might be beneficial. Well, I remember when I'm a little older than you. I remember when I was a kid, they were saying, computers, this was a catchphrase, computers are going to take over our jobs. It was like this hysteria kind of underlying society. Look, how many jobs have computers created? More
I
than
know.
police.
And that's it. Yeah, I
So
mean, it
maybe it'll be the same with AI,
absolutely. It takes over. A computer has certainly taken over a lot of jobs, but look at how many it's created. So like the net gain is a lot more. And I think the same thing with the internet, the same thing with robots. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And I don't see AI as very different. I think it's going to just do a lot of the things that we don't want to do, and it's going to do it a heck of a lot better, allowing us to do so much more with our valuable time. And our time is limited. Computer's time, AI is not limited. That's could be indefinite, immortal, but we are mortals. We only have so much time here, and we got to make the best of it.
So AI is a god. We're bound.
In a way, it can be, yeah, or it could at least be,
Hopefully,
at least could help us.
a benevolent god.
Right.
Now, I see you got on your YouTube channel. I was kind of stalking you online there, checking those out. You do a lot of videos on like social psychology stuff. Okay, yeah, and I was going over them. Like, they got titles like Illusion of Asymmetric Insight, Defensive Attribution Hypothesis, Availability Heuristics. And I thought, oh my God, this crap's way over my head. But then I clicked on a few of these, Bo, and this is some down-to-earth stuff that the regular Joe Schmo can understand. Can you talk a little bit about these videos you have?
Yeah, so I guess if everything I do is kind of encapsulated into one thing, like what I'm really about, I'm about critical thinking. And maybe that comes from my mom again. Maybe it comes from like trying to understand my mom and trying to, if I could go back and kind of explain things to her. But I love critical thinking about things, understanding how our mind works, why we believe the things we believe, and where are the errors in our thinking. There's two major categories of errors in our thinking. One is called logical fallacies, and these deal mostly with arguments, like argumentation. Like, for example, like the straw man argument. If somebody's arguing with you, and then you say, you just make another argument that they really didn't make, but it's easier to kind of attack that argument,
Exactly.
that's called the straw man. And you need to be able to, you need to be aware of that. You need to be able to tell when somebody is doing that to you so you could respond accordingly. Likewise, there's another category of errors in our thinking that are called cognitive biases. And these are basically not bugs in our brain, but features. I mean, it's the way we think. And the reason for that is because we only have so much cognitive energy. And when we go through life, there's tons of things that we need to kind of focus on it, and other things that we don't need to focus on that we could just make these passive decisions. And that's where a lot of these cognitive biases come from. They're kind of like mental shortcuts that work well in most situations and guide us through life, but not in all situations. So we need to be able to tell the difference when we really need to stop and focus and concentrate and really activate our critical thinking on a certain topic versus when we could just kind of passively make these decisions or think a certain way. So cognitive biases kind of tell us how our minds work. And when we're making decisions in the decision-making process or thinking about our beliefs, we could take into consideration these cognitive biases and make a better decision because of it. And one common example for cognitive biases would be the confirmation bias. The confirmation bias is when we tend to believe things that we already believe and kind of push away things that we don't want to believe.
We
So for
reinforce
example, so if we're like a politically liberal, then any like when liberals say things, we're like, yeah, sure, that sounds good. We really don't give it a lot of critical thought. We just kind of accept it. But when like somebody conservative says something, we're like, whoa, wait a minute, I don't know about that. We like really scrutinize it, and we have this tendency to reject it. And that's the way our brain works. It shouldn't work that way. I mean, it feels like if we want to make a better decision, anytime a liberal or a conservative say anything, we should evaluate that information with the same kind of skepticism. And that's kind of the good thing to do. And if you realize that confirmation bias, we're all kind of I guess, cursed with it. When we once we realize that, we can consider it when we get other information and make better decisions because of that.
Yeah, it's good to know these. And you must have a heyday if you ever read like Facebook comments, social media, people start arguing, oh, just full of fallacies.
Oh, yeah.
Comical. Yeah.
And there was a time when I would get involved, but not anymore.
Me too.
It's a waste of time for me. I think it's just, and not only that, but sometimes I feel like this may make me look like an idiot for saying it, but sometimes I feel like I'm beating up on a third grader, and me explaining to them why it's so idiotic and why it's wrong. It just feels like, yeah, like I'm beating up on a third grader. Like they're not worthy opponents.
I wonder if these people, you know, met face to face in a coffee shop or something, if it wouldn't be as bad. There's something about the internet, it seems that.
There definitely is. And that's called like it has a bunch of different names, but it's all about being anonymous. Like if you have that layer of anonymity, then you feel like this extra layer of protection where you could say even more ridiculous things. Whereas if you're actually communicating with someone, even over the phone, you would like rarely say anything that you would actually type in like an anonymous Facebook post or something.
Sure. Wow. Boy, that's a lot of stuff here. We could have a 10-hour show on all this stuff, but unfortunately we're only an hour and we don't got a whole lot of time left. But before we let you go, you're kind of a philosopher. You got any final words of wisdom for our listeners? Anything you'd just like to leave us with?
Well, I guess when I'm asked that question, I like to focus on critical thinking and critical thought. I like to kind of hammer in the importance of critical thinking and how it impacts like not just our own individual lives, but a democratic society. Like a good functioning society at the country level, at the state level, at the neighborhood level. I mean, it's everything is about critical thinking and how you process information. And I think that people should really make that kind of an importance to learn about how the mind works and learn about how they could think better, how they can make better decisions. And most importantly, how they could distinguish fact from fiction, truth from falsehood. That's probably one of the most important things in our day. And it's incredibly important to do that and learn how to do that.
Yeah, now more than ever, I would say.
Yes.
Well, thanks again for being our guest here on So What's Your Story, Bo, and good luck to you in all your endeavors.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
And that is our program for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed our guest, Bo Bennett. And don't you dare move, because Living Art is up next with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson, the two Michaels. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's Community Radio. And this is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes. working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Forget about it.